Good afternoon. We can be in the hearing. Ms. Falk, you're trying to confess the matter. Just before you start, because you attend frequently, it'd be useful to introduce you to Ms. Prendergast, who is in the middle there. She's replacing Ms. Sandman in the next few weeks, so, just so that you know for future reference.
Yes, so pre-lodge level submissions, and yes. Standard reason, so they weren't lodged in that much time, and they are quite lengthy. I don't propose to go through those at all. I'm happy to take questions. And other than that, Ms. Walsh is here. He has pre-filed pre-lodge evidence, and he's also prepared a summary statement of that to present to you today.
There's an executive summary.
Paragraph 55, and that's before I read that out. I think really the crux of the issue for the body's corporate is that they're concerned with Lot 5, which is the site of the former hotel, Brownfield site, currently vacant. And right for development, really. And the Panorama and Panorama Apartments were originally the development of Lot 5 of the Panorama and Apartments. Panorama and Panorama Apartments was planned and designed in an integrated way. It was planned by the same developer and was planned in a way so that all apartments would enjoy views to the lake and really be integrated. And the concern is that under this proposal, there's no certainty at all that Lot 5 will be developed in an integrated way. In fact, under the proposed high-density residential zone provisions, the development on Lot 5 has potential to give rise to quite significant adverse effects apartments. And I note that it's the function of territorial authorities under Section 71 to establish, implement, review, objectives, policies, and methods to achieve the integrated management of the effects of the use, development, and protection of land, and associated natural and physical resources of the district. And I say that Panorama and Panorama apartments are an existing physical resource. As I say, they were planned, designed and built in a way that anticipated and ensured integrated development of all three sites, including Lot 5. And the ongoing integrated management of these sites is a function of the territorial authority. Council's proposal doesn't achieve that. And I say that Mr. Walsh's alternative proposal does. The costs of the council's proposal haven't been considered in terms of particular effects. And particularly in terms of amenity values and the quality of the environment. And therefore the council's proposal fails to adequately provide for section 7 C and F matters. It isn't supported by the council's own evidence, which emphasises the importance of maintaining amenity and environmental outcomes in order to ensure that development in the high density residential is successful. And I say that the council's proposal therefore fails to achieve part two. So just perhaps running through my executive summary, which touched on these matters in a bit more detail in paragraph 55 of my submission. The section 32 evaluation of the high density residential zone places too much focus on economic issues and too little focus on other important resource management considerations, such as maintenance and enhancement of amenity values and of the quality of the environment, and is therefore unbalanced. The proposed high-density residential zone divisions are consequently skewed too far toward intensification at the expense of residential amenity. The Council's own expert evidence is that quality urban design and amenity outcomes are critical to the success of high-density residential areas, and that additional design controls or guidelines may be required to ensure appropriate amenity outcomes. The Section 42A assessment overlooks or pays insufficient regard to the Council's own evidence in this respect. In respect of the body's corporate submission, the Section 42A assessment suffers from the same flaw as the Section 32 evaluation, in that it places too great a weight on economic issues and fails to properly consider other important resource management issues. Further, the Section 42A assessment fails to properly identify and assess the body's corporate submission points on such issues. Additionally, it contains errors and inaccuracies that are material to the conclusions reached and the recommendations made. Accordingly, in respect to the body corporate submission, the Section 42A report is of little assistance and my submission should be given little weight. Overall, the Council's case is flawed and does not demonstrate that its preferred high-density residential zone provisions are the most appropriate for Lot 5 in terms of Section 32. In contrast, Mr. Walsh's expert planning evidence takes a more balanced and considered approach and should be preferred to that of the Council. Mr. Walsh properly identifies and assesses all the relevant resource management issues for designing with Lot 5 and then recommends the site-specific development controls for Lot 5, which appropriately address the issues raised in the body corporate submission by way of site-specific structure plans in conjunction with minor amendments to the zone-wide provisions, while still ensuring the purpose of the high-density residential zone is achieved. Mr. Walsh's recommendations there are achieving relevant objective policies and sustainable management purposes of the Act. And just, I should say, what Mr. Walsh is recommending isn't that different from what is being proposed. It just takes it a bit further and ensures that those important issues, mentioned values and so forth, are appropriately addressed.
Now, just earlier in your submissions, you dealt with this issue of the panorama body corporate joining. Did you want a separate decision on that, or are you happy for that to just be worked into the final recommendations of the Council?
I'm happy for that to be worked into the final recommendations because, as I say, the one of my submissions is just simply the case of changing the name of the submitter, but we're not seeking to alter the scope of the submission or the relief, and so panorama's relief is grasped with the panorama. Concerns will be addressed, so I'm happy for it to be dealt with in the course of the.
It's really on the nature of joining them rather than anything else, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And just on that, I should say that panorama's submissions, issues of concern are very similar to panoramas, but they're slightly different in that, obviously. Panorama is located behind Lot 5, and so the potential effects of development on Lot 5 on Panorama are a little bit different, and there's a much greater potential issue in terms of loss of use for tall buildings in front of the Panorama apartments. But I appreciate that, and I haven't sought to run that argument in any great way, because I appreciate it constrained by the scope of Panorama's submissions, but it's something which I ask the panel to take into consideration. But as I say, if Panorama's relief is granted, then it will address that issue for Panorama as well.
The other question, I've got several other questions, but probably the most important one to be dealt with first. I've got this map, this plan that's off the back of the conceptual map. Could someone draw on for me Lot 5, please? First thing.
That's wonderful. Do that. It's roughly the Panorama development pretty much takes up the site of the Panorama site. And similarly, so
that's what I
panorama. So everything else is Lot 5.
But nothing explicitly before us shows where those boundaries are.
It is on the plan which shows the easement, which is in the Section 22A report.
Yes, but that doesn't have the buildings on it.
No,
it doesn't. It's much more useful to see everything.
The title plans, which are appended to my petitions for Panorama and do show the footprints. But it might be, and I do urge you to go and take a site visit, because you have a better idea from that as to where these buildings sit. And it's pretty clear where the boundary is, because there's structures on the boundary. Although, as I say, you just need to, if you are looking inside, be aware that there are some areas that are used for open space purposes, which appear to be for the Panorama Apartments, which aren't actually on the Panorama Apartments site, they're on Lot 5.
That's what I suspect. Yes. One thing, in paragraph 36, you say that the hotel consent is likely to be implemented. I'm a bit unsure then if the likelihood is that strong, what's the big deal?
Well, because it may not be implemented, but what I'm saying is that it's irrelevant. It's something which you can take into account in the decision making, and that it shows that you can achieve an outcome on the site which is appropriate for the site and takes account of all these issues that are raised in the submission. But I say it's likely to be implemented because obviously the council must have been satisfied with that in order to grant the extensions to the next stage. But of course it may not be, and in that case then the underlying zoning will be very relevant.
Sorry, can I ask you a question? I understand that Firestone had a second extension for this consent to be implemented. How much design have they got for the consent?
I haven't, Mr. Welsh can probably assist you on that further, but the design was for, and I understand it, and what's consented and what's been extended was the Hilton Hotel. So it's pretty detailed in terms of, very detailed in terms of location, height, form, design, the buildings, the landscaping, everything. So it's the full one package of. You would get out and implement that consent and build in accordance with those plans, so it's very, very specific. But that's the question probably to
you.
Not having been on the site, does Lot 5 get views of the lake, etc., over the top of Panorama Apartments?
Yes, Lot 5 is, if you do go on the site, you can see some segments. Photographs and commercial evidence. It's originally a sloping site. Part of it has been excavated, so there's a big hole which lowers the ground significantly, so that gives you that height bonus for the rest to build. But other parts of the site remain largely original in terms of ground level, and they are it's sloping, so you go out there and get views across. If you go, Panamo is in four apartment blocks, and so your view shafts effectively between those, and also Lot 5, part of Lot 5 fronts Franklin Road as well.
It's a question of ground level. It seems to me, looking at the definition that's in chapter 2, that ground level means where the surface of the ground has been altered through earthworks carried out as part of a subdivision under the RMA. And this site's been subdivided as part of the apartments. Doesn't that mean that the present ground level becomes the ground level?
That's
a legal question as well, isn't it?
Well, he's probably more familiar with the definition of the certification than I am.
Right, that's fine. The other question I had is...
Sorry, just on the ground level issue, there's a raise of submissions. His definitions aren't particularly clear, and that could be a big problem.
Well, ground level is always...
Ground
level is always a difficult thing to deal with because it's an ever-changing thing. But it seems that we'll discuss that with Mr. Walsh. The other one is in paragraph 61. You say that the reports, and I presume from that you're inferring also that the zoning application and rules, etc., focuses on the economic issues. And you repeat that later on as well. And you refer to sections 7B and 7F.
There should be 7B.
I'm just wondering. Yes. I think the emitting ones
the maintenance and enhancements of the energy levels.
Yes. Well, that actually is, that was the point of my question. 7B dealing with efficient use and 7G dealing with finite characteristics and natural and physical resources, aren't they also involved?
Well,
yes,
I agree
with
that.
And then later on you refer to paragraph 159 or 160. Again, you say that economic well-being trumps part 2. What about sections 6A and 6B? In the overall scheme of things, aren't those also relevant?
Six A is the preservation of the natural character of the coastal environment.
No, and the margins of lakes and rivers.
Oh, sorry.
Yes. I know a lot of people forget about that part, but it's actually quite important in this district.
Yes, well, there are some elements, I agree, and to the extent that Moksha was an outstanding natural feature. And I think that the matter that you were drawing attention to just support my submission.
Okay. That's a follow up to that. So just following on from that, were we to agree with the thrust of the submissions to at least the extent that we felt that the proposed high density residential zone did not very successfully maintain or enhance existing amenity values, in terms of the particular way Section 7 is structured, i.e. not the same as Section 6 being matters that must be provided for, would it necessarily follow that sustainable management wasn't being promoted? Or another way, does the maintenance and enhancement of amenity values represent an outcome that must be achieved through the plan.
Well, no, it's something that you need to, certainly needs to be considered in the overall mix and weighed up.
No, the purpose of the question was to ascertain and test whether we might agree with you that perhaps maintaining and enhancing amenity values had not been weighted very highly, but it might not necessarily follow that it's automatically an incorrect weighting. It might just be a deliberately low weighting. That's an option you haven't covered, but could explain.
Well, yes, that could be the case for them.
That's a fair point.
And in my permission, that would be a reasonable conclusion, a reasonable approach to taking the circumstances, particularly given the environment we're dealing with here.
Thank you.
And then just finally, in paragraphs 87 to 89, and you're talking about how a consent may be considered, or an application may be considered. I'm just wondering that if the exercise of discretion council has in making such a decision is to implement the objectives and policies of the plan, isn't the basic requirement that any consent will have to be in accordance with those objectives and policies? Otherwise,
objectives and policies. Okay, your question is that.
Sorry, I can't hear you, Mr. Fox.
Sorry. Is your question that? Are you saying that in considering an application, council must have regard to the 104 objectives and policies when it is granting or otherwise a consent? Is that what you're saying? And then therefore they are considered at that point? Is that the point?
Well, I think the reality is even though 104 requires that you have regard to it, unless it's a discretionary a non-complying activity, you would expect the consent to be consistent with those objectives and policies. Well, it would certainly be challengeable, wouldn't it?
Is that are you suggesting that it's because the rules must be given effect to, must be implementing the objectives and policies, and that, so therefore, if you accord with the rules, you.
Yes.
Yes, in theory, but I think in this case there's a bit of a disconnect in that you've got these very detailed objectives and policies, but the rules aren't necessarily ensuring that those are implemented because they don't contain enough detail to ensure that to achieve that. The detail is in the objectives and policies, but it's not in the rules. But that's where it should be. It's sort of tail wagging the dog here.
I wrote this as a verbal summary anyway, so if the panel wants to have copies of it afterwards, then speculate. No problem. So I've already been introduced, I'm not going to introduce myself again. but obviously I've been engaged by Punanga Apartments Body Corporate Committee to provide evidence in respect of the submission on the proposed plan, and my qualifications and experience stated in my evidence, which I am taking as read. And I'll briefly touch on key parts of my evidence, and then I'll move on to making some minor amendments to my evidence. So the body corporate expressed concerns about the high density residential zone provisions. Generally, they feel the provisions are skewed too far towards intensification at the expense of residential amenity. Specifically, they are concerned about the potential negative impacts of future development of Lot 5. and I consider these concerns are valid and have suggested some relatively minor amendments to the objectives, policies and rules to ensure they better achieve the purpose of the Act. Being mindful of the simple, concise and enabling nature of the proposed plan, I have attempted to address the issues in respect of Punaroa apartments in a site-specific manner and limit other amendments that would affect other high-density residential land. The site-specific amendment proposes the insertion of a new rule requiring development within Lot 5 to be in accordance with the structure plan. Other amendments attempt to maximise the potential benefits of high-density residential development by improving urban design quality and ensuring appropriate protection of amenity values. At paragraph 8.5 of my evidence, I have suggested changes to the urban design matters of discretion to ensure that development contributes positively to the amenity, quality and enjoyment of the area. I'm talking about all high-density residential zone land here. While I've considered these amendments in detail, I did not have the necessary time to provide detailed justification in writing. But by way of example, I suggested a matter to be included concerned with the incorporation of crime prevention through environmental design principles. And given crime and safety issues can arise in poorly designed high-density residential neighbourhoods, I consider it appropriate that the provisions address this aspect of design. And this also better achieves the strategic directions objective 3.2.3.1, which seeks, and I quote, achieve a built form that ensures our urban areas are desirable and safe places to live, work and play. And that's just that's an example of just taking for example the thought processes, you know, that I've gone through and suggesting the proposed amendments to those rules of discretion. In terms of amendments, when drafting my evidence, I relied on my recollections of the site from when I lived in and worked in Queenstown, and from a series of recent photographs taken by Laney. Visiting the site yesterday led me to reconsider the proposed structure plan in respect of the western portion of Lot 5. I consider that the proposed setbacks of 4.5 metres from the south boundary and 3 metres from the north boundary would overly constrain development. I consider that these setbacks should be reduced to 3 and 2 metres respectively. In paragraph 6.1, I say that Punaroa apartments cater for short stay accommodation. In fact, they are 50% short stay, 40% longer term rental accommodation, 5% are unoccupied, and 5% are used as holiday homes. I also understand that Panorama Terrace apartments are 40% short term and 60% long term or unoccupied. At paragraph 6.5, I say that all the apartments operate in a dual key configuration. In fact, while all the apartments were designed and built so they could operate in a dual key configuration, only 7 apartments currently have consent to operate in this way. But I understand that an application is currently being made for an additional 35 units to operate in this manner. Thank you. So, any questions from the panel?
Question number?
Thanks.
Thanks, Mr. Walt. The first few questions I'm just going to ask you about your comments where you suggested that the council's section 32 analysis might have been a bit limited because it didn't consider other locations where a high density residential zone could have been distributed, and you talked about Remarkables Park. So that leads to two questions for you. The first is, do you agree that there's actually a problem or deficiency with the current high-density zone that means it should be changed in any event, which leads to both its location and its provisions, which I'll let you answer?
Is deficiency in terms of its extent or the provisions that are controlled?
Either or both. Do you actually agree there's a problem that needs to be fixed with the high-density residential zone?
The operative high-density residential zone. I've I've expressed my view in the in respect of its extent. And that's, I guess, I turned my mind to that, drafting evidence. Not the really impacts to a great degree the concern, you know, the matter that was specifically looking at in respect of development of Lot 5, but it does indirectly. I think, I haven't undertaken that analysis, but I think that there may be opportunity to extend the extent of the high density residential zone, and from my reading of the Section 32 analysis was that exercise hasn't been undertaken. Or if it has, maybe that's not right to say, but if it has, then it hasn't been expressed in the report. So in terms of the provisions in the operative plan, I mean, there's always improvements that could be made. I think that, and it's difficult to comment on the zones in entirety as well, because I understand that the visitor accommodation aspects of that have been removed from the panel's considerations for this as well. So that's part of the consideration of whether they are appropriate or not, because something that was raised in I think the Section 32 and the Section 42A report was about the competition and for residential and visitor accommodation, which has quite a while been an issue in terms of the capacity of the zone for residential for housing the population of the district. So that's something that needs to be worked through, and obviously that's been set aside for another day. I think that the provisions as they are now are workable. To some extent, that they can be more focused. For example, and I think I mentioned this in my evidence, for multi-unit residential development, the matters of discretion, the assessment criteria refer to the urban design protocol. And some of that is a lot less relevant for considering site-specific proposals, which often happen, which is most of the time what you're considering under the plan. So there's some relevant criteria in there, and some not so relevant. So I think there is improvements that can be made to focus them, and council have recognised that and have attempted to do so. And what I've provided is picked up on that, and as I say in my evidence, I've picked up on six urban design matters which I think have done well, lead to good outcomes, and sort of elaborated on them a little bit more than what council's proposal does. So, I mean, in respect of other things, I haven't turned my mind a lot to it, because I guess I was focused on a particular issue of my client in respect of a particular site, and I necessarily had to think a little bit wider than that site, but not.
Good, so let's stop there. So what I think you've said was that you think that while there could be some room for tweaking, the main response would be to extend the area of the zoning, not massively increase what you can do within the zone. Is that the real key summary of your view?
Yeah, more or less.
More or less.
More.
That's good. Okay, so and where that leads is we're obliged to make our recommendations based on the evidence we hear, and an option to us is to recommend to the council that it has to go away and do more work.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've sort of dangled in front of us the question that maybe there's something possibly seriously wrong in the state of Denmark.
Yeah.
And so I want to just test with you whether you're actually advancing that argument. You've mentioned it in your evidence, but it could just be to establish that the provisions aren't that great and
yours are better, but it could be that you're actually advising us that we should be signalling to the council something of a rethink. Is that the case?
Well, yeah. I was conscious of that dangling when I was writing my evidence, because I knew that bringing something like that up would mean that the panel would turn its mind to it.
We certainly don't think that you'd have done it.
That was almost from more, rather than addressing any particular concern of my client, was actually just my professional view in respect of the, you know, of this process and what might result. So, yeah, if I was in your shoes, then I'd be looking at that.
So,
yeah, some questions.
So let's just again just try and just sharpen that a little bit for me. Three options. Which is the one that's closest to your opinion? One option is we could just say it would have been nice if there was some more high density zoning, but it's kind of okay the way it is. So it's a nice to have rather than a must have. The second option is that it's a must have, but it could be addressed by way of future plan variations or add-ons. Or the third option is that it's so integral to getting it right that we really can't advance things until it's reconsidered. Where are you on that spectrum?
I think given the issues that the district are facing, I think this should be a and the opportunity is now to have a robust discussion about this and actually think about it thoroughly and completely. That would be my view. I'd be sending that option through.
Thanks for clarifying that. So, can we then just, for no particular reason or order, just go to the Lot 5 structure plan is attached to your evidence. Forgive my slowness, could you just help me explain what, if any, components of that 9.6 Lot 5 structure plan are your recommendations or suggestions, and what was proposed to be appended to the plan by the council?
None of the council's recommendations are in here. This is all mine.
Thank you. I was desperately trying to find where in the council reports this was. So the entirety of the structure plan is.
Yeah, that's my Microsoft Publisher special. Yeah.
Okay, that's good. So my question then can be correctly directed to you as the author of it. So, in these 9.6.1 development requirements, if an applicant didn't comply with those, how does it relate to the rest of the provisions or obs and poles? What's the consent path, and are there any particular criteria? So you've got some criteria proposed. Do they apply equally whether you comply with the additional rules of the structure plan or not? Or are there different ones, or what's the process?
Yes, so the rule, which I'll go to now, which brings this into play, is on page 19 of my evidence.
Yep.
So there are some rules that are obsolete in respect of Lot 5 because of this, and I've specifically excluded them. And then towards the end of it, I say that I recommend that councils, in considering those an application, that the matters which I've recommended that would be under Rule 9.4.4 would be a guide, and councils using its discretion. But that wouldn't be limited what other things council could also consider.
Yep. Where I got a bit confused by the table on page 19, that new 9.4.10,
yes,
was the proposal is not in accordance with the structure plan, so it's a fully discretionary activity.
Yes.
What's the point then of having those other rules that apply? If it's a fully discretionary activity anyway, why not just go for broke?
Which other rules are you referring to?
All other rules under 9.4 and 9.5 continue to apply.
Yes.
So if it's already a discretionary activity, what are you trying to achieve?
The rest, if you bear with me for a moment, sir, there are other rules that are, I'll just bring up the rules. There are other rules which aren't covered by this. There are other methods that aren't covered by the structure plan. I guess they could be folded into that.
Well, look, what if it's a fully discretionary activity? The council can consider whatever it wants, surely. So why split hairs over complying with a rule or not when you're already a fully discretionary activity and everything's up for grabs?
I see where you're coming from. But I guess you could comply with the development could comply with that structure plan, but then there are other rules in the
Well, no, I'm not asking you a question about if the circumstance of being in compliance with the structure plan. I'm asking about the particular circumstance of not complying with it,
yeah,
which then triggers you into a fully discretionary activity.
Right, I see.
So then why have to reference to other rules?
Sorry, yeah. Yes, no, that's a fair point. I'd agree with that.
Okay. Okay, thank you for that.
And it would make the rule simple.
What do you see as the key differences in terms of objectives and policies proposed between the operative high density zone that applies to Lot 5 and the council's proposed one?
At one stage I went through and actually did a bit of a tabula, it was a wee while ago, and I don't have it with me.
Well, okay,
I had to read through, I mean, obviously they're more extensive, and...
I'll refocus the question, don't worry about it. You're proposing that the policies should explicitly require the protection of amenity values. And I want to know whether that is a requirement of the operative planning framework that applies to that lot.
I believe it is without looking back through and satisfying myself with that. But
okay. Let's just go with you're not sure.
Yeah, the proposed objectives and policies do that also, but they're qualified with the use of the word reasonable, and my amendments was to strip that out.
Yeah, I couldn't find in the operative section 7 any reference to protecting amenity values, but I'm not the one giving evidence. But what I could see was words like does not detract from amenity. Do you think that those particular words, do not detract from, do you think that means the same as protect?
It's substantially similar in your meaning.
All right. You talk about providing for a human scale.
Yes.
What was it you had in mind?
Well, my understanding, and this comes from talking to urban designers that are more qualified than me to talk about these sorts of things, but is that I always want to have pictures to show what the difference between where human scale is provided for and where it's not. But in terms of that vertical modulation of a building, you might have a building that's, you know, 3 or 4 stories high, but if that building is, if there are not any sort of architectural features that modulate the height of it, so that a person can relate to the scale of the building. Because if you had a big blank, you can have a big blank facade and a high blank facade, and that doesn't provide for human scale.
So, is that then? Are you saying that it's about the detailing and design within a facade rather than the size of a facade.
Yes.
So one question I wanted to ask you of that was, do you intend, when you proposed it, or did you intend or foresee or have in mind a 10-storey building or 20-storey building designed in such a way that someone said you can make out a human scale and you can relate to it and therefore it's providing a human scale box tick?
No, I had in mind buildings that were going to be acceptable against the height restrictions that are in the plan. So we're talking, you know, talking three to four buildings.
When you use the words provide for, are you meaning included or are you meaning limited to? So when you've said provide for a human scale, do you mean include a portion of a building that is at a human scale, or do you mean the whole building should be limited to a human scale?
The design of the building reflects the human scale, not necessarily. Perhaps there could be, you know, some improvements to my suggestion.
No, but don't worry about that. Don't read into the questions. I just want to understand what it is you have in mind,
yeah,
so we can consider it fairly. So, I understand your critique of the phrase reasonable protection, and your response is to just use the word protect. Do you see the word protect as being effectively absolute, i.e. meaning something similar to avoid? Protect,
no.
Protect means don't lose any.
No, I don't. I think when you read the objectives and policies of the plan, when you're considering developments, you look across there, and there are some objectives and or some policies and other policies that are tending to do slightly different things, and it's just about balancing those things.
Okay, so while you're not supportive of reasonably protect, you're not intending an absolute protection of every amenity value.
No. And I suppose the amendments, part of the amendments to the urban design manners of discretion, I introduced those manners by saying discretion is restricted to the extent to which development, while bringing change to existing environments, when an area develops, it's going to change. It's just about doing that in a positive way.
Yes, and the question I had was whether you thought if protect was an absolute word, how you can possibly change something while protecting it.
No. So it's not an absolute.
So it's a qualified protection. It's not that. Okay.
I guess my point there is that is the protection of amenity values is qualified, but the other objectives aren't qualified.
Yeah.
So just leave them all unqualified would be my recommendation.
So you proposed in an objective and policy to just have the word protect amenity values, and then by the time we get down to the proposed restrictions and assessment methods, protect has gone to have regard to. And so I wanted to confirm with you whether the words you've written in your assessment matter at 9.4.4 point bullet whatever, let's find it, says has regard to residential amenity for occupants and neighbours. And I wanted to ask whether you thought having regard to something meant you'd implement a policy requiring protection.
Yeah, well, I suppose the way I thought about that is that the policy, in terms of, you know, protection and amenity, is protect. But these matters of discretion are involve that balancing exercise.
Yes, I see. So the have regard to is reflecting all of those objectives and policies you've described, not just the one that's in protect. Okay, that's what you're trying to achieve.
You also talked about the cooperative staff and engaging with streets, and there's some different terminology used. I think in the criteria you talk about streets and public open spaces, but I think in the policies you talk about public places.
Okay.
I wanted to understand what, how in that you saw that private right-of-way through Lot 5, and would these criteria apply to it or not if it was formed as a vehicular access way?
Even if the responding to the public areas, vehicle and places or spaces and streets is of primary importance. But I also, I'm just trying to find it. So there is also, consideration of adjacent development. I'm just trying to find it. Be with me again. I think that the relevant matter of discretion is the bullet point that we were discussing before, which says, has regard to a residential amenity for occupants and neighbours in respect of outlook, privacy and access to sunlight through site design, building, outdoor living and service storage space, location and orientation, internal layouts, landscaping and user screening. So I think that, you know, that's where council would have the discretion to consider how the developments how the development affects adjacencies that aren't public. But it isn't as strongly focused to engaging with those areas, like the first assessment matter of discretion.
So that's sort of what I was asking, and it's a good point, so that's fine. But what I'm really curious to understand is whether on Lot 5, in terms of those criteria you've proposed, accepting wider application, but if I look at your figure 3, which is on page 7, Lot 5 has a little bit of frontage for Frankton Road at that elbow. Would that be the only part of Lot 5 that the criteria proposed about relating to streets would apply to?
Yes.
Thank you. And that leads into a second question about how you've read the plan, where it talks about streets and public places. There's a difference between a privately owned right-of-way that might have a public right-of-way across it or an easement over it, as opposed to a publicly owned open space.
Mm-hmm.
And so where the plan is talking about relating and engaging with open spaces and public places and what have you, how does the issue of public versus private ownership fit into that? Because I have to say I haven't been entirely clear myself reading the proposed plan.
Public use of private places.
Let's say the Lot 5 right-of-way is formed as a vehicular carriageway and a footpath to get into development in Lot 5, and it's got an easement for public use,
okay,
but it's a private way. Is it a street and public place for the purpose of the plan, or is it not?
Well, there'd be an argument that it would be if the public were allowed, were granted access through there, unrestricted access through there. This is an interesting point you make. This is something that comes up. It has come up in my dealings in Christchurch, for example, where urban design matters focus on public places and, for example, we're dealing with a crossing recently in central Christchurch and there's private laneways. They're not part of the bit, and taking up on your point, they're not public. Public are invited there, but they could be locked off at any time. And so council considered it had discretion to consider how the space is within the development rather than just from the streets. And there's legal advice sought, and I think it was established that the council's discretion did not penetrate into the development, was on the outside of it. But that was slightly different because the public access wasn't guaranteed.
So what
if there, if in your example public access is guaranteed, I think it would be an argument. I mean, there's probably some legal aspect to that, and Ms. Walt might be able to help you on that more than I can, but it seems like that might be something where that first criteria that I suggest might actually be relevant in that scenario.
So if it was vested as public street, then definitely it would have, or if it was proposed to be vested as a public street, then the criteria would apply?
Yes.
Or if it was a public open space, say a pedestrian plaza, it would?
Yes.
If it was privately owned, but with an unlimited 24/7 public access easement, which is kind of what you're describing as a de facto sort of private street, it would apply.
Same.
But if it was just a formed private access way that the public could use, but could be blocked off at any time, then it wouldn't. Is that a fair summation?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
And if we were to agree with you that is what the plan writers had in mind when they talked about streets and public places and what have you through the plan, is that the right interpretation? Or should there be a note in the plan that just says anything with public access is treated as a street or public place? Or should the words like, phrases like public place be changed to publicly accessible places, for instance, if we're talking about the advantage to get the plan right?
I think I'm just reluctant to provide a view because I think it's an important point you're making or question you're asking, and it needs to be carefully, and it's something has been considered a number of times for a number of different reasons. I cut my mind back to an application I was dealing with years ago in Remarkables Park, and it was about signage. And that signage, where I was assessing the signage from was way back at the entrance to the commercial area, and from that point it was about 200 metres away. But actually, was that actually a public place because everyone could go in there? I think that. Well, maybe you want to take some further advice, or maybe you want council officers to think about it some more. But I think that there are implications, in terms of development and in terms of how many frontages that a developer will need to engage, and adjacencies they have to engage with to that level, and that starts to get quite tricky. I'm just thinking of another example. I was involved in the still am to a certain degree, the South Frame and this Christchurch City Centre, and they've got a new laneway going through the middle, cutting a block east-west, and the difficulties for a lot of the developers now is that it's a good thing, you've got two street frontages, or pedestrian street frontage and a vehicle street frontage, but then where do you sleep in car parking? That sort of thing. So it becomes quite difficult. So there's real implications for how that question is answered.
Okay, thank you. I'm all questioned out.
Well, can we just revert to the ground level question that you offered to answer for us, please?
So You know, I thought about this for a wee while as well, but I couldn't. It's not as clear in the plan, in the operative plan, as it ought to be, I think.
Well, I'm talking about the proposed plan, not the operative plan. It's chapter 2 of the proposed plan. I'm not interested in what the operative plan says, really.
Yes. Then, in terms of the difference between, you know, ground level, and I'll pick up on the subdivision part of it shortly, but then there's ground level and then there's the defining what a sloping site is and what...
Well, let's deal with ground level separately from sloping site.
Okay, so...
There's a different issue. But.
So ground level, my understanding is that, I mean, you could subdivide land, but if nothing was... no earthworks were proposed as part of that subdivision, then the ground level hasn't changed as a result of that. And in respect to, well, I guess we're going to give you some confidence in relation to whether this site was, I'm going on to sloping, so maybe I want to wait until you're asking your questions about sloping.
The fundamental question then is, the subdivision that created the lots that exist there now, did that subdivision include subdivision consent? Include consent for earthworks?
Yeah, the earthworks have been authorised through land use consent for this.
So they weren't part of the subdivision consent, or if they were, they were different from what has been authorised.
Yes, and I mean, through the consideration of the resource consent for the Harrisdale development, and the all of the parties commonly refer to it as a sloping site. So obviously they've considered that they and at that time it had been subdivided. So obviously they were considering the original ground level was a sloping ground level. And if you look at this, the original ground level it is, because it's quite a steep site.
So I'm just trying to get clear. So by the time the consent that was settled, the subdivision of the site was complete. And this consent was separate from that subdivision, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And that's okay, I'm just trying to get an understanding. So then the question is, right, so it's the original ground levels pre those earthworks that one determines height from?
Yes.
And whether it's a sloping site or not. And you don't need to answer the question on sloping site, because I know the problem there, and we're going to have to deal with that.
Yes. So my answer to the question is yes.
Policies on page 16. This new one that you proposed, ensure developments integrate with the adjacent and wider neighbourhood. Does that mean that if you've got a very ordinary, mediocre, low-rise neighbourhood, that the new development should continue that sort of ecosystem way?
That's not the intention.
Well, could you tell me what you're trying to convey there, please?
The intention of the policy is that developments within a neighbourhood are integrated in terms of they respect each other's orientation and form and outlook and those matters. A lot of those matters are picked up through the bulk and location type provisions and also the multi-unit development rule which has all of those matters of discretion attached as well.
Well,
there is a tension. There is always a tension in a developing area where the intention is to have a high density residential development, and you might have something that's lower density. I think that in that instance where you've got something perhaps that's, you know, that's an older development from another time when, you know, before the area started to change or began to change, or even before there was some sort of plan in place that saw high density residential development, then the new development isn't going to be able to respond to that particularly well, because it's not in accordance with what the zone is. But we do have development that is in accordance with that, with the provisions of this, or the intention of the zoning. Then that's the more important they're the more important developments that new development would integrate with.
Well, that certainly fits with what you're seeking for your client. But if we look at that policy in a general sense in the zone, and the zoning you said should be extended, it's clearly going to be extended if it is, and it already has been applied to areas of formerly low density, low rise development. Respecting the nature and form in those areas, is that really what the outcome should be?
No, I mean, I guess...
Well, would you like to tell me how we should change that policy to do what you were saying earlier?
Yeah, sure. Without you know, sort of providing the specific wording, that policy might be extended to talk about the matters that we've just been discussing about, and the rationale provided before in terms of, you know, that where development is in accordance with the zone provisions. That's what developers are seeking to integrate with, and it's going to be difficult if not impossible if there's older low density residential development, or even newer low density residential development. But that's always the tension when you're extending zoning, you know, when you're either upzoning or you're intensifying an existing zone. It's going to be and you're dealing with brownfield development. There is a tension there, and I guess that perhaps in that new policy that hasn't been reflected as well as it could be. If the panel wishes, I can think about some additional words there and respond.
Well, I was going to ask you if you could provide a copy of your summary that you read out, because you made some changes to the structure plan. We'd like to have that in writing. And I think at the same time, if you want to put in some wording for that, it would be helpful.
Certainly.
Now, just quickly, you've also provided what you call matters of discretion, or restricted discretion, but really they're assessment criteria, aren't they?
Well, that's how the plan is. I went into this trying to being as light touch as possible, given that it's quite a focused concerns that I've been asked to provide evidence in relation to. That could be changed quite easily into a set of assessment criteria.
Right.
But I just used the format that the council had put forward.
Okay. Given those assessment criteria, how much density do you consider could be realistically achieved on your farm?
there are lots of different development options for Lot 5. It's a big site. I'm not in a position without having to, without being able to consider development scenarios alongside, an architect or a designer or and a developer. I just don't think I'd be able to advise. What I have said is that in terms of the proposed provisions for, particularly through the structure plan for Lot 5, is that there are still, because you'll notice in the structure plan is that I haven't reinvented the wheel there. The provisions come out of the operative plan, and so should be able to. There will be the opportunity to develop that land as it has been able to be developed up until the proposed plan becomes operative. In my view, it doesn't unreasonably curtail development options for that site. But in order to advise, absolutely, there would have to be quite an extensive exercise in terms of looking at the different typologies and modelling and. I've been in a position to be able to do that.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Walsh. If you could get that extra material through in the same one, probably by the end of the day would be useful.
I would try, I've got a flight. I should be able to do it by the end of the day rather than close the plane.
That's okay, the end of the day.
Yes. In respect of the structure plan, I'll make some of the amendments
to
the structure plan.
Yes.
And because I haven't done that, I'll just...
Well, then in that case, we could say we'll end by the end of tomorrow. I'm just saying that because our hearings will finish on Thursday.
Okay.
I'd like to have it before we finish the hearings.
That's fine.
Okay, thank you. And I'll adjourn to 12 o'clock.